Hello everyone and welcome to Industry Leaders, where today I'm joined by a very special guest, Lars. Lars, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome, Lars.
Thank you very much, Nikki. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, I mean, my first kind of question for you is, obviously we met through the DNAD panel discussion and I was so just inspired by your journey as a creative and entrepreneur. But my first question is, how did you start out in the creative industry?
Well, I guess I looked over the shoulder of my girlfriend and saw what she was doing on a Mac, and I thought, that looks cool. But before I tell you about that story, I should probably just tell you a little bit about my background, because I'm Danish. But when I was one, my parents moved to the Middle East, and then I changed school 14 times, up until university. And which that just meant that although I liked school and I had various passions around the various subjects, it was difficult to really find what my specialty was, because I would always enter a new school year or mid school year and not really be on the same curriculum. So I started thinking that I would go into banking, because I that seemed in the 80s to be the cool move. I'm so glad I didn't. But I went through the process of applying to become a stockbroker. I passed, and then I had to start wearing suits every day to work. And after a couple of weeks of that, I thought, this is not for me. And then I started studying psychology, which I loved, because it was just incredible unlock of the human mind and, the emotions and feelings that we all go through and just how similar they really all are. But I couldn't see how I would apply it, how I'd apply that trade. And then, as mentioned, Jeanette, my wife, she's a graphic designer. And I was just looking at like communication and design and branding and thinking, this is really interesting and really exciting. And then while I was doing my BA in the UK, I saw in my final year, I saw this really cool poster that had been designed by Tomato. They had an association with this university and they designed the MA's marketing collateral. And it just pulled me in. Again, shows that the power of design. It was a simple poster. There was there's no people there. There was nobody giving a talk, but there's just something there that really clicked with me. And I looked into it and it sounded amazing, because it was a master in hypermedia. And in 1997, that was the very new term. Only a couple of years earlier had I started emailing and browsing and doing a little bit of coding. And I thought, this is an interesting world. And for the first time, once I started the MA, I was taught by professionals who actually were running agencies and consultancies where they were working for the likes of Levi's and, big brands, and they could sort of merge their creativity and commercial understanding and get paid for it. So that was a big attraction, and they instantly became heroes of mine. And, so some of my tutors were Nick Roop, Oven and Poke fame, and Tom Roop, his brother, Richard Barbrook, the professor who had set up the program, and the late Andy Cameron, who in his final years was ECD of Weidman Kennedy. So just an incredible group of people. They also encouraged us all when we were applying to get sponsored, so that we would not just come in there and just have a playground, but also say, actually get a brief, have a client and work towards something big with them. And being Danish, I immediately looked back home and thought, what are some of the big brands that I would love to work with? And I managed to get Lego to actually sponsor me.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I love that. I didn't know that you initially were a stockbroker.
Only for a couple of weeks.
But I love hearing these stories, because when I spoke to Forrest from Wolf Olins, he was saying how he's from a medical background, right? And now he's CFO. So it's really, this is what I love about these talks, is you find out all the different journeys. There's no direct route into the creative industry, right? There's people come from all sorts of different backgrounds. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the psychology background has really served me well, because obviously nowadays it's obvious to be user-centric, but I think in 97, actually thinking a little bit more about, you know, what people wanted and you know, their motivations and what scared them and how they felt uneasy or whatever, that was a massive insight into producing the best design, the most user-friendly, convenient design that also looked great and attracted them.
Yeah, definitely. So then how did you set up your first agency?
Well, you know, as part of my having this sort of scattered childhood, I took up some hobbies. So at the age of 13, I started dealing in candy and sweets, you know, and I had sort of an affection for making a lot of, you know, doubling, tripling, quadrupling my pocket money. And actually, I got so good at it, I think I stopped taking pocket money and just, you know, kept accumulating cash by selling sweets. So I always had a little bit of a wheeler dealer in me, you know, knowing that you could buy something cheaper and sell it at a profit and then, you know, build up a bit of a buffer. And I think that gave me a little bit of guts to actually say, when we were about to complete our masters, that this was worth having a go at on our own two legs. And when I keep saying in the plural form, it's because I met a guy on my master's, Jim Bolton of digital archaeology fame nowadays, who became my best friend. And we did a couple of projects together, and we also managed to sell one of the projects. It was just a student project, but we managed to sell it to MTV Europe. And that it just gave us a little bit of confidence that we may not need to take a job and work our way up through the ranks of a big business. And when we did it the way we did it, we were very cautious. You know, he had a one bedroom apartment, so he worked in his living room. I had a one bedroom apartment, but shared it with another friend. So he was living in the living room. So I just got out of bed, took a shower, had breakfast, went into bedroom again, and just started working away. And we did that for 6 months. And then we decided that actually we should, it's going okay. I mean, we were making peanuts, but, you know, enough to cover our costs and to actually take the big gamble of spending £150 each on renting a desk in London Bridge, and then setting off. And every time we took a step like that, it just opened up new doors, because the second we had an office, we could invite prospective clients around and network around, and they saw we are a real business, and that in exchange sort of unlocked new opportunities for us. And then bit by bit, you know, we rented another desk, and over, I think it was after 2 years, we were 9 people and we were making a bit too much noise in the open plan office. And taking up much more space than the landlord had thought, so we found our own office space in Shoreditch.
Okay, amazing. And what were your first hires like? So it was you and your friend. You rented out the desk space, and then you obviously hired more people after that as well. When do you? At what point do you decide, okay, we need another person?
Pretty early on. Because things were complicated, right? There wasn't any WordPress or, you know, Shopify and platforms like that. And we were in the digital space. So we were doing multimedia projects, intranets, extranets, websites, of course, CD-ROMs back then. And we quickly, you know, we had grander visions than what we could actually fulfill ourselves. And people always say you should hire people that were better than yourself. But for me, honestly, and I'm not being modest here, that wasn't difficult. You know, I very quickly understood that I wasn't the best at all of these different things. So we're very excited as the first hire to hire a CTO. And he happened to be another Dane, Jesper, who was brilliant, who came over from Denmark. And, you know, he single-handedly created our content management platform and our e-commerce platform. And then he started to recruit programmers, and then we I went around. This was a time when the dot-com bubble was raving, the first one, and it was very difficult to attract talent because the big agencies had already signed them all up. So I spent a lot of time walking down Brick Lane, going to all the degree shows, spotting some amazing work, and then chatting to the graduates at the show, and you know, hitting it off together and inviting them into the office and having a look at what we were doing and what we were dreaming about creating. And I was so happy we managed to get most of them to join large instead of joining agency.com or Oyster or some of the other bigger agencies at the time.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's great. This is the thing, like some juniors and grads are so talented when they leave university. And I know whenever I speak to industry leaders and everyone asks about levels, etc., sometimes some juniors can accumulate such great experience that they're almost midweight level.
Yeah.
And it can fluctuate. So at what point did you decide that you were going to sell your business? And what was that like?
Well, you know, it took 9 years, and it was this was 9 very intense years where we were just, you know, every year probably doubling, you know. But if you start off as 2 people, you know, it was pretty rapid growth, but still very organic. Like we never had a year, we never had to borrow money, we never had a year where we lost money, even if there was a dot-com crash, and you know, we were working for the likes of Lego, we kept carried on working with, but we also won Bang & Olufsen globally back when they were a very hot agency, hot brand, Johnson & Johnson to Agent Provocateur. So we had the full spectrum and we really enjoyed it. But I think we also felt a little bit that we had been making it up as we went along. And when you keep scaling and growing and having international offices, you get a little bit afraid and insecure about, are you making the right decisions? And it felt like, well, this is probably a little bit extreme, but it kind of felt like you were at a casino and you were winning. So you were piling up chips, but for every spin of the roulette, all the chips were on the table. So you could still lose. And that's what it felt like. And I think at some point, Jim and I just decided, look, we've built a great business. It's got a great name. We've got a great client list. Great. The team was incredible. But it's probably just time to get some more security in. And we had this big vision that, you know, once we would sell, we would actually have a better infrastructure and more money to make all the right decisions. And in effect, it actually, the opposite turned out to be true. The company that bought us had a lot of debt and they really needed us. And you know, we had to operate more on a shoestring afterwards. And we did, you know, we did really well, but it wasn't the big release that we had, that we'd hoped for.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, I mean, the client list is incredible that you started working with. And how did you attract those clients to start with?
I think we were quite lucky in retrospect, but we also, you know, sometimes it's beautiful to just be quite naive and just actually write letters to people back then, and just go directly to the CMO or the CEO and come up with a proposition. The other thing was that, you know, it was early days of the internet, so it meant that many people were looking and there weren't so many big players. And we used that to our advantage. We were very good at like building up case studies. Our communication was tight so that there was a lot of reassurance of working with us that we felt like very capable and very passionate and also very diligent. And we were early on AdWords. So when people were typing in, you know, web agency London, we often came up as the number one. So, you know, I think there's always opportunities. The point you were making before about juniors that are actually more like middleweight. It's funny, I would almost say the younger you are, the more, you know, the less blinkered you are by your industry, the more valuable you can be for a business. And, you know, CEO of a business is probably the furthest removed from the actual consumers of their products. Mm-hmm. So what you bring of that real insight and being in that culture can be incredibly valuable going forward. I think we just had that youth and the digital revolution on our side. But I would say the same has been true of other businesses I've built since. You know, there's always opportunities in the market. There's always something that has made me upset either about our industry, about how brands are communicating, or the experiences they've been providing. And it's evolved over the time. Obviously, the types of services that you know, we provided later on were very, very different. But I always think there's, if there's something that makes you mad, that's a good thing. If there's something that you feel I can do this better, that's a great thing. You know, you can get stuck in, prove it, and just take it step by step.
Yeah, definitely. And junior talent, they're the lifeblood of any agency. And I do wonder, with the fact of due to the pandemic, the fact that less juniors have been hired, how that's going to affect agencies. Because if you think of what, you know, junior generation are doing and producing, it's absolutely incredible. And I know there are creative directors and founders of business that are looking at things like TikTok and how, you know, younger people are communicating and going, oh my goodness, what is this new technology? And they could actually probably benefit from having some of those people in their team.
I think with communication or design or digital marketing, you know, in the old days of advertising, there was actually a real art and science to it, where if you went to an agency, they knew better. They knew how to construct the perfect brand story, image, the right positioning, the right distribution in stores, the right pricing, and get it into your shopping bag. Nowadays, it's social media that's so prevalent, and you can't really go to the agencies. The consultants there, they don't have 500,000 followers. Right, so it's not, they're not the real experts. They can, you know, have a beard like me and drink Guinness and be very smart about what you need to do in your social media strategy. But actually, have they got the finger on the pulse? I know who I'd go to, and also the pricing is completely different. So if you can actually, you know, fund younger talent, you can do more and you can experiment more, and thereby sort of find new ways of achieving your success.
Yeah, I agree. And so what's your process like when you work with clients?
Well, I think it's changed over the years. You know, when I started out the first agency, I was 24. I guess it was to my advantage that I was balding, so I looked a little bit older than I was. But you know, we were compensating a lot for our age and inexperience. So we were very sort of buttoned up or buttoned down, depending on whether you're American or English. You know, we had a very, so we called it the scientific process. We did audience profiles. We were very user-centric, came in with this behavioral psychology and did all these user journeys and user experiences. And we started doing that already in 98, 99. And, you know, and also what we could see, the dynamics of a room that, you know, people love to talk about whether they liked yellow or orange. And, you know, we wanted to create tools that we could manage and maneuver the right solutions through, you know, the process. So we did wireframes. We did all these, like, what are the calls to actions? What are the messages we need to get across? And what are all these sort of accumulated touch points? With time and experience and, you know, some claims to fame in the baggage, now I go more with momentum, because I feel that, you know, now there's a bigger need for speed and competing and being in market and iterating and trying out many more things, and I've got the sort of the experience of being quite rigorous, and I feel I'm not taking a flyer at all, but I just believe that we can work faster. There is this famous quote about consultants that they take your watch and tell you what time it is. And there's an art to, in the early days, that we were really good at taking the brief, answering the brief, making and giving them a little bit more, making the client. And we weren't that aware that that's what we were doing, but that was the task they'd given us. Whereas now I feel like the value is more in taking the brief, understanding the problem, and coming back with a solution, which may not be a one-to-one answer on the brief. And that's what excites me nowadays, is to sort of create a few more moonshots and disruptions and transformations.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we've all seen a whole different way of working off the back of the pandemic. I know that all these brands had this message and these campaigns that they were just about to release, and then all of a sudden it just wasn't appropriate to do that anymore. So they're either rapidly creating or being very reactive. I think we're living in quite tumultuous time, aren't we, where right now brands are having to A, communicate, and B, be very responsive and reactive, which fights against the old models of this is something or a campaign that we need you to design that needs thought and all the rest of it and execution compared to at this current time. What's one of your favourite projects that you've worked on that comes to mind? You can name any.
Yeah, I was trying to think of that. I think I have a habit of falling in love often and frequently, and I think every time that a new brief comes in, a new challenge, gets super excited. I generally get super excited about it, especially, you know, if I like the people, if I like the business, then I can find, you know, motivation and in all of it. As I mentioned in the intro, I've kind of worked on everything from actually from colostomy bags to sexy lingerie to luxury watches. And they've all had their just interesting challenges. I think we've always been at the cutting edge of the digital revolution and new methods of working. So it's always been about like breaking new ground, trying out new things, actually being able to pull off the vision that you had and not just deliver something that you'd done many times before. So at different stages, you know, very incredibly proud of the work we did 98 for MTV, because I think we got something like 4 million people to go to the website from MTV Europe because people could create these interactive animations that would be played behind the presenter. And that was just because that's what I thought interactive TV would be. And it didn't turn out to be what interactive TV was, but it was very fun and very interactive. And it meant as people were submitting their animations, they'd go to the TV and watch if they'd been picked out and were actually helping create the design of MTV. It was a big milestone when we did the global Bang & Olufsen website and e-commerce platform. We had, you know, Bang & Olufsen back then was, you know, the most luxurious hi-fi company in the world and very, very aspirational. And we launched, you know, stereos in 2000 or 2001 that just sold out in 3 weeks. So it was kind of like a Yeezy drop, but we did it in 2000 with stereos and we just had 1,000 of them and we sold out. Unfortunately, we had a client that didn't quite understand just how amazing that was because they had fulfillment problems of actually producing them and sending them out. So from them, they were like, we're never doing that again. And we were like, no, this is incredible. Like you can be, you know, they could have been Apple back then if they sort of understood what they actually had and the power of the brand and changing the time to market from, they had this sort of value or principle that they would only release established technology, but they just kept being 5 years behind DVDs and Blu-rays. And when they finally released them, they're already aging out again. So they've had a very, very tough time. Then I think another milestone was when we became global AOR for E-Trade. So that was everywhere but the US, and that was great because it was such an international client and business, and to actually again understand the nuances of countries and people and culture. So that was great. And then on my time with running Virtue globally, you know, I had just moved back to Denmark from London after 19 years in London, got my kids integrated in school. We loved being back in Denmark. And here comes Vice and they offered to buy my business and make me the global CEO of Virtue in New York. And that was not part of the script and not something that we wanted to do. But I remember going home and speaking to my wife, and I sort of said to her, I said, look, there's two businesses in the world that if they offered me this job, I find it very hard to say no. And that was Vice and it was Apple. And then when I went to Vice in New York, the first project I won was Apple. And then I ended up spending, you know, 6 months commuting to Cupertino from New York, where we helped develop and refine Apple Today, or Today at Apple, you know, which has been their sort of whole engagement and entertainment experience. So that was so much fun. I also realized I was kind of glad I didn't end up there, because they simply have too much money. They have too much time and resource. I like a bit more momentum, but it was an amazing, amazing project and obviously incredible brand.
Yeah, that is so incredible. It seems like you've always, since you were at university, worked with these great brands, right? That some of the best brands and companies in the world. Do you think that there's a formula behind that, or a secret perhaps you could share as to how that's happened for you? Or
I just think be a great listener to what they need, be a great observer, and try to really be rigorous in understanding their situation, the market they're trying to speak to, and the consumers. Deliver what you promise, do it on time, do it on budget. Growth is kind in agency world, is kind of very simple, right? I always boil it down to two things. One is win work. So if that is just like, and we can break that down, we can unpack that in many different ways, but what does it take to win? Because without winning, you haven't got any work. And then the second one is, once you deliver work, make sure it's so amazing, on time, on budget, incredible quality, that they immediately hire you again. That's the secret sauce to building an agency. If you unpack it, you should obsess. I guess I've been pretty neurotic about how do we get in, taking that opportunity, speaking to them first, getting in front of them, checking in before the pitch date, and actually show them what you're thinking to get a sense of what they're like. And it is crazy, but you've got to be a little bit crazy to sort of thrive in that environment. But it's a competition. And if you don't do it, somebody's going to get there first, and you'll lose out. And then you won't be able to sort of fulfill your dreams. And there's this Chinese saying that Jim and I used to serve up to each other all the time, which is, you get three chances in life. If you take them, you get three more. If you take them, you get three more, and so on. If you don't take them, you don't get any more. And I believe that to be very, very true, and very, very true of the success I've been fortunate enough to have, because I have been the guy that took the breakfast meeting, that jumped on a plane tonight because we had an opportunity in Milan to say yes, you know, even though I was meant to be home at a certain time and do something, to go a week to Indonesia to work on a factory floor because a client thought that was a great idea. And it was a brilliant idea. But I kept saying yes, I kept doing it. And that's something I'm trying to rebalance now in my midlife, where I can't keep saying yes. And I'm a big family man. I love my wife and children, and I want to spend as much time with them as possible as well. And if you keep saying yes, that means when, you know, the email ticks in at 11 p.m. on a Saturday and somebody says, oh, I'm out with the head of so-and-so, you know, do you want to swing by for a drink? I said yes. And that became a 10 million pound contract. You know, I'm thinking specifically of Coca-Cola here, but I would do things like that. I think that's it. It's just work incredibly hard, obsess about how you can do better. Don't be complacent. Don't think you've cracked it in 4 hours. Look, there's many people that have been trying to impress these brands and people before. They worked damn hard at it. So, push it, keep refining it, keep making it better, and be as good a person as you can be in as part of it too.
I actually remembered that saying that you, when you said it at the DNAD panel, and that's something, yeah. I actually Googled it afterwards and I thought, that's so right what you said, because that's how I try and run my business and what I do, where I say yes to lots of different things that I explore. And if you don't and you miss that opportunity, you're so right. You use those three chances and then three more materialize off the back of that.
Yeah.
And then you never know where it could take you. And I guess that's the thing. It's about being open about the journey and the opportunity and where that can lead, and approaching that with enthusiasm and never just taking it for granted and resting on your laurels that you've nailed it ever.
And keep learning. So one of the examples were, because we were so good at AdWords, the BBC called one day and they were like, oh, you're like a branding agency. Could you come in and comment on McDonald's latest strategy to do this? And like, I couldn't think of anything more terrifying, not being, I've got decent grasp of the English language, but actually going on live TV of the BBC, BBC Breakfast, and start to talk with the news anchors about branding. I just couldn't imagine anything more terrifying. But at the same time, we agreed I would do it because that would, you know, what a claim, you know, what a moment to actually talk about with others. And I don't think I did particularly well, but there were three clients or prospects that I hadn't heard back from for 6 months that had actually, while they were drinking their cup of tea in the morning, had spotted that and got back in touch with us. So that just opened up something more. And then, you know, I carried on for several years just turning up on TV and making some commentary on what was going on. And I didn't sleep the night before. I was, you know, shaking the whole way in way in the car. But I forced myself to do it because I knew that it would lead to something else.
Yeah, no, that is great advice, Lars. It reminds me of once when the gender pay gap was announced with the BBC, and then there was a journalist whizzing around on a scooter, and they actually came to our recruitment company and they said, will any of your recruiters answer this question, why there's a gap? And no one would do it. Yeah. And I said, well, I'll speak to someone. And yes, news journalist, completely unprepared. Like, I hadn't done, you know, like my hair or makeup or anything, wasn't wearing the right outfit that you'd want to be seen on telly in. And this kind of male journalist kept saying to me, men are paid more because they're better negotiators. And I kept telling him things like, no, it's because men are promoted above women, you know, motherhood penalty, all these things I was telling him, what happens in the industry of a certain age. And then the final cut of what they showed on the news was a female from the industry saying men are better negotiators. But then that got me on a whole new journey as a recruiter and someone that advises the industry and then a TED talk. So you just never know, right? If you don't say yes, then you don't know what could have happened from that situation, that experience. What's some mistakes you've made? And how did you overcome them? Because sometimes you can pivot a mistake and kind of rectify it. Have you ever had a situation like that?
Yeah, I think one mistake that I kept doing for a while that I really regretted was, at the expense of culture, keep growing. And that meant that at times, because in the agency game or dynamics, it's like you're a couple of people, you pitch for some work. If you win it, you actually need to staff up, because obviously you didn't have just people sitting around doing nothing, and then you keep staffing up as you're winning more work and expanding the clients. And at some point, you know, we were doing so well and just kept growing, and we hired too fast. So suddenly you would accept people that weren't culturally right, and maybe because they were just, you know, look, we're doubling whatever they're getting paid, we're getting paid the same in profits, so let's just have them, even though we didn't really think they were right. So that's something I regretted in my first business, and it's something I wrote down as a value and principle that I have on my phone, on my post-it notes, etc. You know, I really don't compromise on people's personalities and their values, because you have to work with them, and the whole agency actually suffers. And there was a time when after we sold Large, and you know, I've been one of the execs at Story for a couple of years, I set up a new agency, and there I specifically needed people from fashion, because we had a big fashion and retail client, and I hired somebody who'd been creative director of H&M, who's perfect for the job, but he made everybody else sad, and he didn't make them better. And it's, you know, and I was really struggling because he was brilliant and he had all the right experience and everything that he did, the client just loved. But after a couple of months, I sat him down. I said, sorry, it's not working out. And we parted ways. And I thought it would leave a massive gap, but everybody else just stepped up and they loved more working at the company even more after that because they knew we were so principled and had great values. So it's a great learning that it's, you know, it was kind of not functioning well when there was a rotten apple in the mix. And then I think the other thing of just making mistakes, when you're trying to always working on the cutting edge and invent new approaches, you're constantly, you know, have a vision and ideating around things that haven't really been made before. And of course, you hit a lot of bumps on the way and apply a lot of stress to your colleagues and team members. But it's also working through that way you get stronger and get the experience. So, you know, it's a mistake, but it's a good mistake. It's this thing about actually failing and failing fast and getting better and learning from it. And next time you really know what you're talking about because it wasn't just smooth sailing. And it's a chicken and egg situation. You can't just keep selling what you've done before because you would never get to do it if you didn't at some point say, I can do this and you just have to trust me.
Yeah, definitely. And what do you look for when you're hiring in a person?
Talent, passion, personality, and discipline as well. You know, actually, it doesn't have to be, you know, being able to sit at a desk for 9 hours and straight, but actually just, you know, hitting the deadlines and making sure that we, you know, we're a team, so we're not, you know, left with holes in it. But I think I've always said I'm about talent. I'm not about pigeonholes. You know, I don't really like starting with an org chart and just saying I need this specialist. I'm more about like meeting amazing people in a space. And if I see the talent and I think it fits in, we'll find a role and we will sort of, we can be fluid enough at the business to fit them in if they're the right talent because they'll make us better. So that's kind of how I've always hired. And I can be very envious of the people that can just write the perfect job description, the perfect org chart and you know, sit and tinker with some spreadsheets, but it's not how I lead. You know, I lead more with teams and culture and momentum and you know, keep getting those successes that just, you know, build up your confidence and momentum even more.
Yeah, definitely. Well, going back to what you said in regards to culture, I know Bill Brock from Analog Folk used to have "Don't hire assholes" as in like the manifesto. And then they hired this new HR consultant when they became bigger and more successful. And she said, "Yeah, you've got to take that out of there." And he's like, "But we still mean it. You know, it's all about the right person and personality." And this is advice I always give to people: if you've got creative A and creative B that are equally as talented, but one's a real pleasure to deal with and one is a headache to deal with, the one that's a pleasure to deal with is always going to get the work because it just makes life easier. So how have you been affected by the pandemic?
Well, I've been very fortunate that I haven't been so affected personally, but I think what I see by the industry and clients is, you know, everything has become more on an edge. You know, it's more crystallized, the issues, and you have to accelerate the change and the improvement. And of course, there's a lot of governments holding their hand under businesses at the moment, which is great, so they can survive. But there were also a lot of businesses that probably didn't serve a great purpose in the same way before because they were just antiquated and they're sort of just dull or whatever. So I feel like now everybody's getting more competitive. They're finally innovating again. You know, no longer are we tinkering on plus minus 5% on, you know, where we should allocate the budget, but now it's more drastic measures and a more accelerated timeline, which I love. And I wasn't planning on having such an intense year the last year, but I've just found it so fascinating and interesting time to go out and compete and getting things done quicker. So I feel like there's a lot of things I've been involved in that normally would have taken 3 years that suddenly took 3 months, which is just, it's great. It's like, yeah, that's a thing that can wear an entrepreneur down, right? Is actually the fatigue or impatience. So I think it's been an entrepreneur's year from that respect.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've seen lots of people have wanted to be involved with more work with purpose as well. And there's lots of zombie companies. That's the term that you read about all the time, don't you? And that have been picked up by the economy, that the minute that the government start easing off that support, we're going to see a real landslide. But hopefully the innovation curve, which I'm personally very excited to see,
develop
fruition. And new ways of working. I've got clients that are looking at whole new approaches, you know, people working from home more, what that means in regards to salaries, you know, sprint work cycles. There's all these new ways of working that are coming out of this moment.
But it's a such a tough year. It's depressing, isn't it, for us all? And it's difficult to, you know, keep being motivated, and especially if you thrive. I mean, I really miss being physically together with people, because I think, you know, there's definitely new ways of working, and I've also personally become much more disciplined, because you need to write really tight briefs when you're not sat together. But then again, I also miss a lot of the small discoveries and check-ins and coffee, water cooler moments, where not just socially, but also where you actually talk about a project and check in and course correct and innovate and stuff like that. So I think the future is going to be a mixture of both, because that creates a different dynamic. It's I have a great friend who's a cardiologist and does a lot of writing and research, and he sort of said that the issue with medical research is that you kind of have to know the answer in your application in order to get the funding, which just means that there isn't enough disruption and innovation there. So here, you know, and that's often what happens in a more creative environment, is that you sort of clash a little bit more and you find different energy and discoveries and discussions that create something new and some new energy. And it's very difficult if we're all just sat at home answering the simple brief that we've been put in front of us and complete our task in 8 hours and then clock off and just turn on again tomorrow. I'm looking forward to hugging and seeing everybody again.
Yeah, same. I can't wait to have like in-person events and like in-person panel discussions, because what happens is you have these great like talks, and sometimes when more people are involved, and then you just, I remember judging at DNAD, and then you just put your laptop down and you're like, you've got all this adrenaline from that moment, and then it's just quiet. And I miss mingling afterwards, where someone would ask you a question, you'd be having drinks, and just, I really miss that as well. I can't wait. Yeah. So we go back to that. So I've asked, I could go on, but I'm going to allow other people to ask some questions. Okay. But thank you so much for answering those for me, Lars. So, so first question is, as a self-taught designer, how do I show my work experience in my CV and cover letter for agency internships? I freelanced for a couple of years and would really like to get into an agency. No luck so far. What advice would you have on that?
Well, I don't think I don't actually think the education matters so much in the creative industry. I think it's about how good a designer or creative you are. So it's all about portfolio. And you know, you have to find ways where you can break through and get that relevance, whether it's building up an Instagram profile or whether it's a Behance site or Cargo site or whatever, wherever people are that are looking for at creativity. That's where you need to be and be showing your work. And then when you contact people, sure, write a nice cover letter, but make sure they see the creator first. It's like, that's the job you're gunning for anyway, not to be you know, a copywriter or letter writer for them. So, and it's very, I would at least say from my point of view, it's always very instant. You just see something and you like it or you don't like it. So work really hard at that and keep iterating. So, you know, if you're writing, when my girlfriend applied as a graphic designer, she, you know, I think she sent 100 applications and got 17 replies, and they were all no's, and the rest she didn't hear from. This is back in, so some while ago. And then Jim, my business partner, said to her, "So what you gonna do now?" And she said, "I'm gonna write 100 more." And I thought that was so cool. But it's also about changing the cover letter, changing the lead graphic, etc. You know, this was also a time when people weren't hiring so many creatives. So just keep at it, keep trying new ways. If you build and if you build out an Instagram and that isn't working, change it. You know, change your, obviously stay true to yourself, but show a new side of yourself that you think can land well with your potential employer.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Like, and in regards to cover letter, when I did a talk with Sophie that headed up recruitment at Wieden & Kennedy, Sophie mm-hmm. Worth, that's moved over to Oatly, she said it is all about your portfolio. And your portfolio is like, it's the only way you ever get to present creativity without a client brief. Yeah. This is your brief for you, and that you're showcasing your work. And there could be ways that you can experiment with how you put that together. I'd say PDF portfolios are good as an initial taster to show your editing skills, but then show some links like a Behance or an Instagram, etc. So,
And network as well, like meet people in the business.
Yeah.
You know, go out and just and hear how they've done. Like, I used to send letters to people and emails just asking them questions about, like, how did you get your first job? How did, you know, what are three things you would, you know, wish you knew when you were applying your first job? And it unlocks so many different things. And you can both, you know, get an in with them and learn how they did.
Yeah, networking's really good advice. There's so many groups that you can join in on, and Zoom calls, and there's been ones where I've been on the panel and then you're put in rooms with individuals and then they can like introduce themselves to you, and you find people give you like a mini pitch. But if they're quite interesting, then you'll say, "I'll send me some stuff, I'll take a look," and that's a way in where you've met the human and the person, and then they send their work rather than just being a cold email, which isn't as personal really if you're trying to win some work.
Exactly.
Or a booking. So next question is, how did you go about selling your idea to MTV? Was it a case of, "Hey MTV, we've got this great idea for you," or was it more formal than that?
Well, in that particular case, I actually had a friend that was doing another master's at the same time, and he was an incredible networker. Like, he came from a wealthy family and his dad was like a super high flying CEO, and he just knew how to get in with people and like connect with the tutors, etc. And he got a job, he got an internship at MTV, and then that evolved into a job. And I'm not really the envious type, but I actually remember that night I went to bed, you know, age 23 or 24, thinking, "Bastard, that's the job I wanted," you know, because that was the coolest channel back then. And then that night, I sort of just, I guess, my sort of desire to go work there as well just meant that I came back in the next morning. I don't think I'd slept at all. I sort of built out this prototype and this idea that I thought was really original. And then went in there, got a chance to show it. This acquaintance of mine, he was the guy who had sort of opened the door on this one, and he got like 7 promotions in a year. I think he ended up as VP of MTV Europe at the age of 23. We got paid terribly for it. I still remember we got paid £2,700 for 6 months worth of work for 3 people. But again, the door you open, where does it lead to afterwards? And it's totally unfair. I mean, it's obnoxious. But at the same time, I just knew that if we could say we're working for MTV and Lego already, that meant that, you know, you had some not bragging rights, but you have credibility to have a conversation about the next project, and you don't need to tell them what the other clients paid for it.
Yeah, so true. Like you say, though, that you get your free chances or your cards, then you take those, and then your next free. Okay, so how many gigs did you win because of your pool skills?
Yeah, it was a pretty good pool play. But this is maybe one of the secrets to my being an entrepreneur as well. You know, it's resilience and grit being an entrepreneur, but it's also being a risk taker. And you know, I won the two largest pool competitions in Denmark when I was in my late teens. And when I moved to the UK to study, I just happened to be at the Susie Q's, where there was a couple of suits observing me playing. And they came over and said, oh, can you do some trick shots? Can you do a bit of that? And I actually, you know, then I became a professional pool player while studying. So it meant that I always had something to fall back on. And, you know, I'll never go hungry, because I can always go and play for a tenner down the pub and you know, buy a kebab on the way home. But I used it. It's a fun, you know, it's something about my personality that I think clients and suppliers and colleagues have thought is fun throughout the years, is actually going and having a game. And I remember this printer that I used to use, where, you know, I would always call up and complain about pricing. You know, I'm always trying to get it a bit cheaper, because you have to make the margin, otherwise you can't, you know, make the best work culture in the world. He wouldn't really give in. So I said to him, Steve, I'll tell you what, why don't you come down to the elbow room? If you win a pool, you know, I'll pay 10% more. If I win, I'll pay 10% less. And he lost, but he was a, you know, he was a good loser, and we saved 10%, and he had a laugh, and he had something to go back and tell his colleagues about.
Yeah, I love that story. Was there ever times you turned down a project because it wasn't the kind of work you wanted to do or direction you wanted your agency to move in?
Yes, many times. So you can probably tell that I was always... You know, I was also doing the business development. You know, I was always taking the meetings and meeting the clients and meeting the prospects. And, you know, we never had real, like, official salespeople. But I think it's a real benefit, because it means, first of all, if you don't hit it off with people, it's difficult to create creative chemistry. You know, if you don't have the chemistry, it's difficult to be creative together. You get to pitch your ideas along with your teams. And if they don't like them, they don't buy your ideas. If they like them, there's a high likelihood that they like you and your ideas, and you're going to have a fun working relationship. So I think that was always the way of sort of filtering clients and relationships. And it's, you know, everything I said about winning, obviously, if you win something and you oversold it and you can't deliver, I mean, that must be terrible, right? That's just pain, because it's, yeah, sure, you worked 3 weeks on the pitch, but now you have to work 3 months together, where every day they speak to you, and every time you see them, they're miserable because you overpromised.
Yeah, definitely. Because you said you worked so many different, was it cosmetic bags you worked on and all sorts of your career? And so...
Hearing aids... So many different things, but you know, you can't, sometimes we couldn't you know, we needed some more revenue to sustain the team we had, and like I said, we found the challenges in it that we love doing. And I mean, colostomy packs, that is an essential product and service to people. Actually, you know, it's a incredible business that provides wound care and stuff like that. So we really found the purpose in that. And you know, I still remember the analogy that we used for the strategy was, this is a pit stop. You know, you want to be racing Formula One, but you pull in, get it sorted, and get back on the track. And when you come at a project like that, you know, your strategy is very clear, the user experience is very clear, the design is very clear, and it was a lot of fun to execute.
Yeah. Definitely. So what's one of the most memorable portfolios you've ever received from a candidate? Do I need to bring to mind?
I don't think. I think there's still potential out there. I wouldn't say, I mean, obviously I've seen many portfolios that were just amazing and I could see how they fit. I haven't been on the receiving end of something truly innovative in the way that it approached me. I've heard stories of people buying AdWords with the names of creative directors. So when people with big egos Google themselves, it says, "Hey, Jack, maybe you should check out my portfolio instead of Googling yourself," or something like that, which I think that sounds fun. Or people that auction themselves, or that, you know, do guerrilla marketing or whatever, that gets the attention. I don't think I've been on receiving end on something totally ingenious, but obviously I've been suitably impressed by their professionalism and aesthetics and ability.
I think sometimes, unfortunately, designers get very wrapped up in this whole trying to do a really out there portfolio, and really sometimes just keeping it simple, clean, clear, making sure all your hyperlinks work and the work that's featured on there is a very high standard, polished and professional. It's all you need to do, really. I'm very mindful of time, Lars. Have you got time for one more question, or have you got it?
I do, sure, go for it.
Okay, let's think of, so what's your favorite brainstorming techniques and how do you brainstorm virtually at the moment?
Oh, I think my favorite technique is the one where you have to start every sentence with yes and. So as you're brainstorming, you're always making things better. And that's something I run on good vibes. I run on the chemistry, the energy that we create. So it's always about, like, how can we make it better? How can we, you know, always never settling, you know. The negative side on that is called neurotic, but the other one is like ever optimistic, of just saying, no, how can we actually push it further? And I think with vice and with virtue, that actually unlocked the real proposition of virtue, which was to say, you know, we can create a branded documentary, yes, and that can be an event, yes, and that can be a guest list, yes, and that can be, you know, a roadshow, and it can be a Netflix series, etc. And instead of just being very siloed, so that has taught me a lot about, like, trying to find this sort of way of grouping things and making it more cumulative and in the proposition that you do, and just, you know, yeah, making the ecosystem greater. So that's probably the best technique. The other one is really immersing yourself in the culture that you're trying to be a part of and contribute to. So I've for the past 11 years, I've been giving people £2,000-3,000 a year to go travel and it's inside, you know, whether it's the market or in the space, because I just love it when they've been out and experienced it firsthand. Last year, was it maybe a year and a half ago, we had 20 people from Copenhagen that went to different parts of the UK. So we just looked at, where can you fly to? You can fly to Glasgow, you can fly to Bristol, you can fly to Gatwick. And then people went off on planes and drove to Norfolk and drove to Blackpool and Wales and stuff like that, and meet the local people. And they came back like shell-shocked and inspired, because it wasn't the UK that they thought they knew, because they'd only ever been to London.
Yeah, a good friend of mine was the internal recruiter at the time on that project at Vice, Ben Tanner, and I remember him telling me about that trip, Lars. He was like, oh my God, we went on the best trip. And that he told me about the list you created where they had to find the cheapest pint or like a packet of pork scratches. Like, you'd listed all these very British things that they had to go and locate.
You had to be called Love if you went to a corner shop. You had to get a snake and black at the pub. You had to, you know, do all these different things. And this was actually, again, it was from my time being a pool player in the UK. So, you know, I would travel all around. I went to Doncaster, I went to Sheffield, I went to Blackpool, I went to Newcastle. And so I felt like I knew more of the real Britain. And then I, you know, there were these were some of the points that I'd really enjoyed.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, I will end this here and I'll let you go. But thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate
pleasure.
It. And
great to see you.
Yeah, you too. And thank you everyone that joined us today as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, take care.
And everybody go for a run now. It's not healthy to sit in front of the computer all day.
Yeah, exactly.
Or try to
get up for some exercise.
Yeah.
Today.
Take care.